It has been a turbulent decade here in Vancouver, to say the least.
Check me out, y'all.
Halford and Brock.
In your area.
That's right.
About to cause mass hysteria.
Sportsnet 650.
Hughes, a drop. He scores.
I've never seen a young defenseman like Quinn Hughes.
It's halftime.
Horvath with two. Horvath with three. Patrick.
Look at him.
Hey, yo, it's halftime.
Now Besser off the drift one. Accepted by Patterson. He scores.
It's halftime.
Playoff atmosphere. Look at the boys go. Crank it up. Let's go.
7:05 on a Thursday. Halford Bruff, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Bruff in the morning is brought to you by Able Auctions. If you have business assets to sell, email them at sales@ableauctions.ca. We are also brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today. Visit your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. To the phone lines we go. He joins us every week on this program. It's Greg Wyshynski from ESPN. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
We're good. Thanks. I imagine you must still be reveling just a little bit in the excitement and drama that you got to see firsthand at the Coliseum last night.
It was crazy. It wound up being a pretty good game. First period wasn't the greatest, I didn't think, but the rest of the game was really, really dramatic and fun. And it had all the playoff stuff you'd want, you know, with the, you know, dramatic injury and some tight penalty calls, and, you know, obviously an overtime winner, and then the fans dousing the ice with any projectile filled with liquid they could find, which was really cool, and not cool in the sense that they did it when the players were on the ice, as I pointed out in my ESPN daily wrap up this morning. Probably don't want to do that, but the rest of it was really cool. The idea of just sort of like, I don't know, man, like pouring one out for the Coliseum is how it kind of felt. Mm-hmm. as people were like there 15 minutes after the end of the game, still throwing stuff on the ice. It was really a really cool scene, I thought, provided that, you know, they didn't do it when players were still out there.
One of the things Mike and I were talking about earlier in the show is how young the fan base looks for the Islanders. And I'm not saying that's like it's a bunch of like kids there, but there seem to be quite a few in their early 20s, and I'm wondering if this is an entirely new fan base or if this is something that's been passed down by their parents or the community, because it looks like a really fun and it sounds like a really energetic arena.
Well, it's a totally new fan base because nothing markets hockey better than 2-1 games, you know. So no, I'm kidding. It's a generational thing, and I've been doing some reporting on Islanders fandom and the Coliseum, and it is just very much the vibe of like, I used to come here in the 80s and as a kid, and now I'm taking my kid here, kind of thing. And you feel that. I mean, listen, there's a beautiful thing about Islanders fandom. Just like there's a beautiful thing about Devils fandom, of which I've been a part since I was a kid, in that we both live in the shadow of the Rangers.
Right.
And because of that, you sort of develop this natural underdog, scrappy, blue-collar, us-against-them vibe, because, you know, you're playing in the same city as the villain from an 80s teen movie with a sweater tied around their neck, you know? And so that vibe pervades Islanders fandom. I mean, that's why the Coliseum is such a special place. It's shaggy. I mean, it's, you know how like when you go to an arena now and they have like all the food places are branded for local restaurants, you walk in an NASCAR Coliseum, it just says food and drink,
yeah.
You know, and then you go get it. Like, it's like government provision. You know, the first sign that you see as you're walking up the stairs to the press box, has the word asbestos on it. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a real, you know, shaggy old barn. And it kind of fits with the aesthetic of what being an Islanders fan is. As one fan put it this way, when we won our Stanley Cups, we had a parade down Hempstead Turnpike. And when the Rangers won their cup, they had it in the Canyon of Heroes. And there was confetti being thrown from windows, from skyscrapers. You know, that's the difference between those teams. And that's kind of the aesthetic of being an Islanders fan.
They also sell asbestos at the concessions, too. It's they got drinks, they got hot dogs, and they got asbestos.
Well, it is actually, it's pretty good on popcorn, if you've ever had it. And if you have had it, you've probably never had it again, because you're dead. So,
it's a one-time experiment.
Hey, Wish, we got to talk about the cross-check on Kucherov, because I liked your tweet, and I'm paraphrasing here, but Scott Mayfield had two great shots last night. One top corner to tie the game, and the other one on Nikita Kucherov that at least contributed to Kucherov missing the rest of the game. We just had your old pal Jeff Merrick on, and we were talking about how the NHL probably needs to crack down or at least draw the line on cross-checking. And, you know, Merrick's pretty old school, and he doesn't complain about the officiating too much, but this is getting out of hand when players like a Scott Mayfield, who's a pretty tough customer, feels the freedom to be able to just cross-check one of the star players in the NHL right in the ribs and knows he has a pretty good chance of getting away with it.
Well, it's just stupid. I mean, like, it's clearly a penalty, no matter how you want to frame it, whether you want to frame it as cross-checking, whether you want to frame it as interference because it was away from the play. I mean, like, there's a billion different ways you could have looked at that play and said it should be a penalty. It's not about cross-checking. It's about the playoffs. I wrote about this today in my column. It's a good column. I think you should check it out, actually.
I'm on it right now, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it's very much just this problem that we have of them calling two different standards. And I know this is, like, not breaking news, but I think it's gotten to the point where it's sort of ridiculous. I found out in my research through the Elias Sports Bureau that the two lowest penalty minutes per team per game seasons that we've had in the playoffs have occurred in two of the last 3 years.
Yeah.
The last two times that we had a postseason that wasn't in a bubble are the two lowest penalty minute per team per game seasons that we've had in the last 30 tournaments. Okay, so something's going on here where they're calling it a lot tighter than they normally would, and they're not calling enough. And so, I mean, a cross-check's a cross-check, right? But if you're going into these games and looking not to call penalties, which the referees clearly are, and Bill Daly from the NHL told me that their position is that they tell the referees to call the same standards. So it's coming from somewhere. I don't know where, and I don't know how this is. I don't know if it's just like a shared history where they just decide to call it to a different standard in the playoffs en masse for these officials. But it's less about the action than it is about the consequence. And the consequence in the regular season would probably be a penalty, but in the playoffs, it's not.
You also brought up in the article one of the things that I always come back to, and it's if we can't get a definitive ruling on a lot of these rules, which is fair because, you know, Merrick pointed out earlier, it's interpretation of some rules with regards to cross-checking, goalie interference, and everything. I get that. The accountability factor to me is the big one because at the very least, if a referee is going to make a decision call where he had to interpret the rules, then he should try and explain that decision in the aftermath so we at least know what the line of thinking was. And you brought up a good point. The NHL's opened this door with the Department of Player Safety. We get 4-minute detailed video analysis of why each ruling was made. Like, that's one of the most transparent things that the league does. For some reason, that just doesn't parlay over to what's going on with the officials on the ice.
And it's an easy fix. Like, no one's saying that Chris Lee needs to stand in front of a media press conference and tell us why he didn't call a penalty on, you know, the guy punching Nick Suzuki in the face as he's watching Nick Suzuki get punched in the face.
Right.
I mean, that would really add a lot of complication to what's already a complicated job for these guys. And I'm sure Merrick would say the same thing because he's, you know, a bleeding heart defender of all referees. I learned that the hard way over the years.
Yes.
But, I mean, having the supervisor of officials of a series act as that proxy and help us understand why some of these decisions were made, that's only a good thing. And again, like you said, the Department of Player Safety example is a great one because agree or disagree with what they do, at least you understand where they're coming from. At least you have a better understanding of the rules with which they're working and the criteria with which they're working than if it was just here's your suspension and you know, who cares? Mm-hmm. And I think in cases like what we've seen in the playoffs, like, let us know. And if the ultimate answer is our guy screwed up, okay.
Yes, great. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, we all understand there's human error, and you know, you'll be better next time or whatever, but at least we'll know then, because honestly, like, the ticky-tacky stuff that doesn't get called, that's one layer of it, and we see it every playoff, and I think that if you're going to really try to grow this game as a game where the Connor McDavids and the Austin Matthewses are the ones that bring new fans to the rink, then you best call it the same way you call it in the regular season, because no fan's going to watch 82 games of one sport and then four rounds of a completely different sport, which is what's happening right now. But, you know, that stuff's going to occur. But tell us about the big stuff, man. Like, give us the breakdown on how Braden Point gets a goalie interference penalty after getting cross-checked by an Islander into the Islanders' goalie. Like, come out and tell us that stuff. And I think it would really help to, you know, defuse the bomb a little bit as far as, like, how people have been so negative about officiating. It sucks to have to talk about officiating every
Oh, it's so boring. I can't stand it. It's like debating suspensions. Like, I would rather do anything else, and I think it shows, because we usually and we're in Vancouver. Like, Vancouver is, we love complaining about the officiating for the most part here. Like, we're still talking about a series 10 years ago and the officiating and that. So when it gets to this point, and do you think the Kucherov injury, and whether or not he plays, if let's say he doesn't play game 7 and let's say the Islanders win that series, could that be enough for so much media attention to pile up that the NHL essentially has to do something about this?
No, I don't. I just think that they're just going to keep doing it. I mean, you know, the injuries happen, they'll probably say. But keep this in mind, too, about Kucherov. And I hate saying this because I like, you know how much I like a clean narrative, right? He did finish his shift, and he did throw a hit on Barzal later in the shift. And he threw it right around where the door to the locker rooms was. And it was after that hit that he really started to, like, get a little labored and, like, double over. Now, I think it could easily be that, you know, he didn't realize how much damage the cross-check did, and that's ultimately what felled him. But I'm a little hesitant. Mm-hmm. It's not the clear line of, like, stick to face, guy goes down, goes to locker room type thing. He continued on in his shift a little bit. Which might just complicate the Scott Mayfield took out Nikita Kucherov thing. I'm not saying that that's what hurt him. I think there's a better chance that it's the cross check that hurt him. But, you know, you go back and watch the full shift. He's still kind of Kucherov-ing around after taking that cross check a little bit.
Then he got hit with a beer, I heard.
So I hesitate to really kind of, like, you know, put Mayfield in the guillotine based on the totality of what happened last night.
We're speaking to Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. We should focus on the other series because it's had bad officiating too. It's the Montreal Canadiens and the Vegas Golden Knights. How shocked are you that we're at this point, that the Habs are one win away from the Stanley Cup final?
I'm truly shocked because I thought Vegas had figured itself out in game 4. And you know, if you go back for 5 into Vegas and you lose an overtime game or something weird happens, you get a bad bounce. I mean, that stuff happens, but they laid a total egg in that game. They were terrible in that game. I mean, they swapped out Lehner for Fleury, which was a puzzling move to begin with, but it certainly wasn't Fleury's fault that they were playing so sloppily in front of him and giving a puck away. And, you know, elite defensive players like Mark Stone making defensive lapses in that game. So, that was the biggest surprise for me, which is how bad Vegas was in a position where they had a real chance to turn that series on a dime back in their direction.
Who's going to be the next coach of Seattle Kraken? Because apparently, according to Ian Furness in Seattle, it's not going to be Rick Tocchet.
It's not going to be Rick Tocchet?
Ian Furness, a tweet from just about 20 minutes ago, half an hour ago. So confirming this morning, it is not Rick Tocchet as the Kraken's head coach. All we know right now is the 10 a.m. newser is not for a jersey, sweater, mascot unveiling. Head coach will be announced. Ron Francis is real, real good at keeping things under wraps.
He goes on to say, he goes on to say that the most discussed group is Joe Sacco, Tony Granato, and Kevin Dineen.
Yeah, Dineen was one that kind of came in a little late, and he's been looking to get another crack at some point. Obviously, Dineen has a long history with Francis. The Sacco one is interesting. I know there's always been some people thinking he should get another shot, but Granados certainly has a lot of support too. So those are three kind of off the board a little bit choices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually quite happy it's not Tocchet. I got to be honest with you. Like, his teams play hard. They succeed if they have really good goaltending, and they don't really create enough offense for my liking. So I'm kind of all right with that if it's not him. But that's really interesting. Yeah, Seattle's really good at this clandestine stuff. I actually had the JT Brown story of him becoming a color commentator for them like a week before it was announced, and I got to see firsthand the cone of silence the Seattle Kraken have already established in their young history. So I didn't see that report. That's really intriguing, because I just assumed that Tocchet had been the clubhouse leader. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. I think the expectations on the Seattle team are going to be really unfair because of what Vegas did. There's a lot of circumstances beyond anybody's comprehension that happened in Vegas that allowed them to do what they did and have allowed them to do what they've done subsequently. There's clearly, you know, going to be stakes pretty early for the Seattle team to be not an expansion team. And picking the coach is obviously the first step to that.
We're speaking to Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Before we let you go, Greg, I wanted to jump back to the Montreal-Vegas game. Tonight you mentioned the goaltending situation. Who starts for Vegas in this do-or-die game?
It has to be Lehner. It has to be Lehner. Like, yeah. You just watched him play one of the best. He had one of the best performances of a goalie in the playoffs in Game 4. And now, you know, you sat him again, so he'll be angry, and he'll read Twitter, and, you know, whatever. And I think you have to go back to him. And then if they somehow extend the series to 7, then you've got yourself a real conundrum on your hands, don't you?
Yeah, we talked about that.
Everyone, and you got to pretty much commit to Lehner for the rest of the run.
Do you?
Well, don't you? Because if you win Game 6, you're going to go to Lehner for Game 7, and then if he wins that, you have to start him in the Stanley Cup Finals, don't you?
Do you? Because I don't even know.
I mean, I think so. Unless it's like 8-7 in Game 7.
Good. He's clearly pretty good coming out of the bullpen.
Yep.
I mean, like,
man,
I think that people were like shocked by it when they started him in 4. I thought that was a brilliant move. Fleury had been a below replacement goalie in the previous 2 games, and it's not like you're swapping out Vasilevskiy for McElhaney, right? Like, this is a 1 and a 1A, or 2 1s, you know? There's a reason you're paying Lehner the money you paid him, is because you believe in him, and you believe that he's every bit as good as Fleury is. So, you know, if you have that luxury and you can swap out, there's no problem there. It's not, you have to kind of break out of the paradigm of, like, this is our goalie for the playoffs. I mean, that's not how it works in Vegas, and maybe it's not how it should work in a lot of places. The point of it, boys, is that it does not matter who starts in goal. If you're going to score as many goals as they have in the series, and you're going to get one goal from your top 5 goal scorers in the regular season against Montreal, you could start Bill Foley in goal, the geriatric owner of the team.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter, because you got to put the puck in the net. You got to generate offense, and they simply haven't been able to against Montreal, but they're not the first to have that problem.
Is this a Vegas thing? Because I all due respect to all the goalies that have done this against them, but I'm starting to wonder if this is less about Demko and Talbot and Price and more about just the way this team operates, that they are wildly inconsistent when it comes to scoring goals. They'll have stretches where it looks great and they can't stop scoring, and then they have these stretches where they can't score at all. Because
they looked so toothless against the Habs in Game 5. Like, they had no answers whatsoever.
But they
barely racked up the shot totals.
Yeah, but they got... go ahead.
Let me answer that question with a question. Can you name their centers?
Chandler Stevenson, better known as Chandler Bong.
Ms. Chandler Bong.
William Carlson. Nick Roy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Who's maybe been their best one in this series.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple more.
Yeah.
I think again, like, the most obvious thing can be obvious sometimes, which is that if they don't win this series, and if they, you know, fall short of the cup, that the next position they'll address is the center spot.
Jack Eichel.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be. I mean, they've got the pieces, but then again, they're going to have to really blow up their roster from a financial standpoint in order to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that is the ultimate, you know, solution there.
The Canucks are getting William Carlson. They got Nate Schmidt, and now they're getting William Carlson. Yeah.
They have to. I mean, like, that's the sometimes you can win with your Andy McDonald as your top center,
yeah, right.
You know, like the Ducks did. But if you're Vegas and you need to generate offense and you're looking for, you know, no disrespect necessary, I think he's a good player. But if you're looking for Chandler Stephenson to make a play, you've done the defense, you've done the wingers, you've done the goalies twice. And you got to do the center spot because that is really the glaring, and it's very glaring in a series where literally anybody has an advantage at center.
Yes.
Against Montreal, right?
And, no, it's a
and
good point.
Vegas, it's either even or Montreal has the advantage in the series.
As a subscriber to the chaos theory, I do kind of want Vegas to bow out here and then have Bill Foley and Kelly McCrimmon and George McPhee go into another offseason and just be like, we're getting another star. I mean, when the Stone sweepstakes happened, they were front and center. When the Petrangelo sweepstakes happened, they were front and center because they felt they needed those to get to this cup that Foley wants so badly. If they lose, the internal motivation gets jacked way up. And speaking of Jack, there's Jack Eichel on the horizon, right?
Look real quick. I know everybody wants Eichel there. That's fine. That's like the little brain version, okay? The bigger brain version is Malkin. That'd be the bigger brain version.
Wow.
And then the galaxy brain version is Evgeny Kuznetsov in Vegas.
You can't put Kuznetsov in Vegas, man. There's no way.
I mean, you can't, but wouldn't you love to see it?
Yes. It's the greatest thing you've ever come up with. It's amazing.
He's playing with a lot of energy tonight.
Yeah, he's got a lot of energy.
Yeah, I was going to say.
He's got a lot of energy.
Kuznetsov is dialed in.
You can't put Kuznetsov within that. He can't be in that close of proximity to that many hotel rooms. He can't.
Kuznetsov's time on ice is 55 minutes.
He's still going. It's amazing.
The next day, not here for practice.
Wish, this was good stuff, man. Thanks a lot for doing this. We appreciate it. Enjoy the game tonight. Enjoy the rest of the week. We'll talk next week.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. The galaxy brain version is Kuznetsov in Vegas. That is amazing. Never even thought about it. Makes total sense.
Has enough been made of the fact that Nick Suzuki has probably been the best center in this series? And wasn't he drafted by Vegas?
Yep. There's that picture floating around. Yeah. Yeah, of him celebrating with Kelly McCrimmon and George McPhee upon being drafted.
Yeah. Well, Pacioretty, I know he was the only one to score for Vegas the other night.
Yeah.
But overall, they're probably sitting there going, you know what? I think I'd rather have Suzuki than Patches.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was part of when they broke
part
in.
Part of the strategy, though, right?
Right. When they broke in and they stockpiled all those picks and made all those picks, they did kind of acknowledge that all these guys, all these young prospects, might not stand the test of time. They might not be Vegas Golden Knights for long because they had so many of them. They used them as capital to go out and get guys like Pacioretty, like Stone, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't begrudge that, but hindsight being 2020, could you not have a more perfect fit for this team that doesn't have a really potentially high-end center than Nick Suzuki, who looks like he's going to be that? Coming up on the program, we've mentioned this a few times, I'll mention it again, 8 o'clock hour, Canucks general manager Jim Benning is going to join us for a lengthy chat about everything that's going on with this organization currently and everything that's about to. Remember, in the next 30 days, Jim Benning is going to have to prepare for the NHL entry draft, the Seattle expansion draft, free agency, the buyout window. Oh, and by the way, they're moving their American Hockey League franchise across North America. It's a lot on his plate, so he's got a lot of stuff that we can ask him about, and we will.
And he has to train the Sedins.
Also that.
All right, this is where we have our coffees in the morning.
To show them where the bathroom key is.
That's right, yeah.
All important stuff. That's all coming up at 8 o'clock, so don't miss it. It's the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
Trey Young's going to bring it back down for the Hawks. 2:35 to go in the quarter. Trey dribbling behind the pick. Now Trey crosses over. Stops. He sets. He shoots the three. Bang! They left him wide open, and he did a set shot.
7:34 on a Thursday. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Brough in the Morning is brought to you by Able Auctions. If you have business assets to sell, email sales@ableauctions.ca. We are also brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today. Visit your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. Trey Young, huh?
What is a sex shot?
Is that what he said in the
clip? That's what he said in the clip.
Trey Young, huh?
He hit a sex shot.
I think he meant sexy? Set shot.
Was it a set shot? Did they do set shots anymore? Yeah. Tom Chambers playing?
Trey has a very funky shot.
Well, he did the little wiggle because it was wide open.
Okay. Yeah.
He did a hezzy, a hesitation.
Maybe it was a sexy set shot.
It could have been. Yeah. He's got a funky shot, though. I mean, it's lights out, but it's not a picturesque. Like, Red Auerbach was not making videos of the perfect form when he was looking at Trey Young's jumper.
Who has the ugliest shot in NBA history?
Lonzo Ball.
Lonzo Ball's bad. Sean Marion's was really bad. Sean Marion's was gross.
What about Reggie? He kind of had a weird fling.
He had the wrists clicked together.
Yeah.
But
Reggie Miller.
Yeah, Reggie Miller. Yeah, yeah.
Reggie Jackson?
Not Reggie Jackson, Reggie Miller. Yeah, it was unorthodox.
How about Bill Cartwright at the free throw line?
It was bad.
Ooh. It was interesting, wasn't it?
Robert Parrish.
Oh, you know who had an ugly shot? My man, Laimbeer.
Yep. It was like kind of hold the ball high. And then,
it almost looked like a soccer throw-in.
Yep.
That would be a good way of putting an appropriate way
of
describing
it. Hold the ball over your head and then you just kind of flick it. Well, when you're 6'10", you can do that, right? Because the ball is right at the rim height.
Okay, yes. We got a big interview coming up at 8 o'clock with Canucks general manager Jim Benning. Obviously, Jim Benning is talking to the media in the wake of the Canucks hiring the Sedins. Mm-hmm. And our poll question this morning, we should ask Jim this one. Will the Sedins eventually run hockey operations for the Canucks? And I'm asking this question just because I want to know what the fan expectations are for the Sedins. Mm-hmm. Are they being groomed to eventually take over? And right now, 74% of you are saying, yeah, the Sedins will eventually run hockey ops for the Canucks. And I think this is why the organization, these expectations, this is why the organization was very careful when it crafted its press release to suggest that the managers are still the managers.
Yeah.
And it mentioned Benning and Weisbrod and Chris Gear, and that the Sedins would be working under them. Mm-hmm. And this was a learning experience for the Sedins. They're coming in to learn, first of all, to provide some value and helping the Canucks culture, but also to learn the likes of, you know, I think one of the Sedins said yesterday is like, just how to make a trade. Like, how do you do it?
Yeah.
You know, that would be one of the things that I think it's the administrative stuff that maybe there's not enough appreciation of how that stuff actually happens. Now, it might be a very quick lesson. It's like, oh, you just do this, and then you call the NHL and you say, we made a trade, and the lawyers do some paperwork, bada bing, bada boom. Then you call your HR people and you get the new player set up and is, you know, make sure he gets a ride from the airport and all that sort of stuff. But like, that's all part of the managerial job.
Right. And they need to learn that. I mean, they said yesterday, you know, we're coming in as rookies. With regards to the poll question, is the ultimate end goal to run the whole show? Do you come in, as the Sedins have done, thinking that at the end of this learning journey, we're going to be running the entire thing? Because for a lot of ex-players who are incredibly competitive by nature, the goal is going to be get to the top or learn as much and get better and better and better to the point where someone wants to hire you to run a team. Because let's be honest, you know, players retire from hockey and then they go into coaching. And the drive is there to be the best. It's to win a Stanley Cup. It's to be the best coach. To be recognized as the best coach. A lot of it is pride and, quite frankly, a pissing contest about winning Jack Adams and getting paid the highest salary. If you don't think that's a thing among coaches, like, you got another thing coming. Like, they very much, they're competitive guys. Mm-hmm. They all are across the board. No one's in this because they're not competitive. From a managerial standpoint, all these guys that start out at the player development or scouting ranks, most of them have an end goal, And it's not to stay in scouting or player development. It's to become a general manager, because there's only 32 of those jobs. They're pretty elusive. And to put your stamp on an organization to say, I'm better than other general managers. I beat that guy. My team beat that guy's team. That's just, and so with regards to the poll question, we've already talked about how competitive the Sedins are, how driven they are, and how determined they are to succeed. It's hard to look at it and think that going into this, that wouldn't be their end game. Like, I would be very surprised if they were content being a liaison between the American Hockey League team and the NHL. I would.
Yeah. No, so would I. Now, for the record, the Sedins said, look, there is no game plan for us with this. We're coming into the business. We're going to try and learn all we can, and we'll see where it goes, which is fair enough. But you have to imagine, like you said, like, it's almost understood that if the Sedins go into something, they're going to try and do the best job that they can. And if they're good at that job, they're going to progress to the point where maybe they would take over the team. And I don't know if there's any other team that the Sedins would be interested in running.
Well,
that's another thing about them. Like, one of my big issues with the Canucks hiring Trevor Linden to be the president of hockey ops was it was too much too soon for Trevor Linden. With all due respect to his career, his work with the NHLPA, his work in entrepreneurial businesses, he had no front office experience, and the Canucks made him the boss of everything.
It's the fundamental difference between the Linden hire and the Sedins hire. Is the Linden hire, he got thrown into the most prolific job, I would say, because he's the president.
He was the president of hockey ops. He wasn't the president of the team in kind of like a, is a funny word, titular? Like, he wasn't just like, teehee. It wasn't just a symbolic presidency, right?
No, not at all.
He was Jim Benning's boss. And ultimately it led to him saying, well, you know, if I'm not on the same page of ownership and Jim Benning's on the same page with ownership, well, you know, the Canucks, I guess, eventually said, well, Trevor, you're out of here. But Trevor was probably like, yeah, I mean, fair enough, right? Like, we're not on the same page. That doesn't really happen if it's just Trevor Linden's only job in that position was to come in and kiss babies and talk to season ticket holders and make sure they buy tickets.
Yeah.
He was in operations. And with the Sedins, they're doing it in a different and, I think, far smarter way.
Yes,
agreed. Bringing these guys in and saying, hey, this is a tough job. You got a lot to learn. There's a lot of things that are going on that you probably didn't even think of when you were a player. But it also presents a bit of a weird scenario and weird optics in that, are the guys you're going to be learning from the guys you're eventually going to replace?
Weird, but not uncommon. It's happened countless times in the NHL. I brought up the examples the other day of Steve Yzerman and Julien Brisebois. Steve Yzerman had an opportunity to go to Detroit, which was totally separate from the conversation. But at the same time, Julien Brisebois had worked under him for such a long time that he was getting consideration to be the GM elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want. I think that's inherent. If you bring in good people and you bring in people you think are going to be assets to your organization, you have to do it with the mind that, okay, this guy might be so good that he might replace me. That's why we never bring in anybody new here. We talked about this yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm not bringing in an intern. What if he's better than me at radio? It's not that hard to be better than us at radio. It's really not.
That's why we have Dom as our producer. No threat.
I've never felt more comfortable.
Exactly.
In my employment status.
It's the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. We got one segment to go before the Jim Benning interview at 8 o'clock. If you want to text in any comments or questions, maybe questions that you really want us to ask, text them in to the Dunbar Lumber text line at 650-650. It is the smart alternative. Visit Dunbar Lumber on Bridge Street in Ladner or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com.
Got my first real six string. Bought it at the five and dime. Played it till my fingers bled. Was a summer of 69.
7:48 on a Thursday.
Say it.
Nice. Is that the only reason you played this?
As summertime feels.
Attaboy.
What's the best summer song? Is it DJ Jazzy Jeff?
Sorry, what?
The Fresh Prince. DJ Jazzy Jeff.
Yeah, no, you got
the
it.
The Fresh Prince.
That's good.
DJ Jazzy Jeff.
What?
He mumbled through it.
Oh, okay. I know where he was going with that. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Like Summertime in the LBC by the Dove Shack. That's a good one.
Kenny Chesney has a good one too. It's called Summertime.
It's called All Kenny Chesney Songs. Alan Jackson. Does Alan Jackson have a definitive summertime song, or is it just Chattahoochee?
Probably Chattahoochee would be a summertime song.
That's fair. There are there's a lot. Let's just put it that way.
Country music is for me. Mm-hmm. I'll start listening to country music when the weather gets good.
So right now?
Yeah. I've been actually listening to quite a bit of it.
There you go. Have a couple of Hey Y'alls. I feel like Hey Y'alls and country music go hand in hand.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. And it makes me miss Nat Bailey Stadium, too. I nearly cried there.
Yeah, it does. I miss the Nat a lot. This would have been a great weekend to go watch some ball. It's scorching. Can't think of a better way than to get an aggressive sunburn in the bleachers at the Nat. It'll come back soon, though, hopefully. A reminder on that note, Andy Dunn, the president of the Vancouver Canadian, a few weeks ago came on the show, and there is that the dangling carrot for baseball fans and Nat Bailey fans in this province that the final 12 games of the Canadian season are all scheduled to be at home. Right now, their home is Hillsborough in Oregon, but the first chance that they get to come back to the Nat, Andy Dunn basically said, we're back. I do need to talk about Able Auctions, right? Before we end this nub segment and get to Jim Benning. Halford and Bruff of the Morning is brought to you by Able Auctions. If you're closing your business and you're not sure what all your assets are worth, let Able Auctions help. They've been helping BC business owners wind down and sell their business assets in an orderly manner for over 30 years. Whether it's a complete manufacturing plant, a restaurant, or a mechanical shop, Able Auctions has seen it and done it all. Email sales@ableauctions.ca and get your free-of-charge confidential consultation scheduled today. That's sales@ableauctions.ca.
Okay, let's set our goals for this Jim Benning interview. First goal, don't embarrass ourselves. We'll probably fail with that.
Identify him correctly off the top. Don't refer to him as Brian Benning.
Right, okay, good. Start small. I would actually like to get a bit more guidance on his plans for the Canucks this offseason.
Sure.
The only thing we've heard is that he's going to be aggressive. So what does that look like?
Be aggressive.
Yeah, there you go. Is. So one of the questions I'm going to ask is, like, can we expect some pretty drastic changes to the roster? And if we can, how do you go about doing that? Because they're either going to have to trade a significant asset or clear cap space, which might cost assets. Someone texted in a question for Jim Benning would be like, would you be willing to trade the 9th overall pick?
Good question.
Here's another question I have for Jim Benning.
Okay.
Do you need to start restocking the prospect group? Because a lot of them have graduated.
Very legitimate question. You have a American Hockey League team coming here to Abbotsford. Are you going to begin the process of stockpiling it with good young talent and not AHL assassins?
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, we talked about this with J-Pat yesterday. There's not a ton of good, young, intriguing prospects currently in that mix. There's a couple, but no one that you would earmark as being on the cusp of stardom.
Who's the best Canucks prospect that isn't expected to be in the lineup next season?
The Canucks lineup.
Yeah.
Jet Wu?
DiPietro, maybe.
Mike DiPietro, yeah.
Other than that.
Jonah Gadjevich, Cole Lind.
But yeah, but those, okay.
But
I'm not getting mad at you. I'm getting mad at the prospect group.
I'm not saying it with any great enthusiasm. I'm just throwing out names. That's probably
Jack Rathbone is expected to be in the lineup, I would say, or at least
J-Bone's on his way. I would say.
Putt Colson, obviously.
Putt Colson's going to probably be in the NHL lineup, I would
Hoglander
guess.
Already is.
Yep.
William Lockwood.
He's got a pretty good shot, I think. Getting in on the forecheck.
Very interesting prospect because I think his style of playing his game translates better to the NHL than every other level. I think you could find a niche for that guy. Because that's what they always say about players that come up to the NHL. You got to find something that you do really well. Mm-hmm. And Lockwood's is I skate super fast and I crash into the end boards, sometimes injuring my shoulder in the process. But
Tyler Mott is like, I'm interested in this.
Tell me more about your straight line speed. I think that he could be a more effective player. And it sounds weird because you would think that a guy who was a standout mm-hmm. in Michigan and played pretty well for Utica. But I think if you tell him to keep it simple and do maybe one or two things really well, I feel like he's got the skill set to do that. Maybe more so than a guy like Cole Lind, who
I
might
don't
have
like
more
Cole Lind's chances at all.
But I think Cole Lind might have more inherent talent, if that makes sense. But in terms of being an NHL player, the stuff that he does, there's a bunch of guys at the NHL that already do that better than him.
He doesn't move fast enough.
Yeah.
It's the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Our interview with Jim Benning coming up next.